Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC, 13 minutes after 9 o'clock. Roundtable panel just assembling now. We had a media project over in Studio D, and I see Alan is still over there, but he's making his way over. So I'll introduce who's here. We have Chairman of Capital District Latinos, Dan Irizarry. Hey.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Nice to have you here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
And we have investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo here on time twice in 1 week. Welcome, Rosemary.
You're supposed to give me positive reinforcement.
I am. That's great.
Sounded like a shot.
No, not far.
My New Year's resolution is to not be late to the roundtable.
What's the number one rule, right? Be on time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the number one rule for success in life, so they tell me, not having been all that successful.
Be there, not on time. Why? I never understood punctuality as a virtue.
That's a good point. Well, you've never worked with too many drummers then. Albany County District Attorney David Soares is here. Hello.
Hey, how are you? I'm here on Thursday just because I was told there was a breakfast.
Oh, yeah, there is? That's coming. Yes. Yeah, so I think we have some those soda crackers in the other room. We'll be bringing them in a little bit. And then we're waiting for Alan Shartok, who will be here momentarily, presumably. The email address is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, if you would like to join us with a brief message this morning. Again, I say the rules, and I feel bad about it if you listen every day, but we do have to say it. No links, no attachments, a couple of sentences, keep it short, no abbreviations, and do proofread if you can. panel@wamc.org. Cars, cots, plastic chairs have become temporary beds for hundreds of families who lost their homes in the strongest quake to hit Puerto Rico in more than 100 years. The magnitude 6.4 quake that struck before dawn on Tuesday killed one person, injured nine others, knocked out power across the territory, and a majority of Puerto Ricans remained without electricity as of early yesterday, improving but very, very slowly. Nearly 750 people were staying in government shelters in the island's southwest region. State of emergency has been declared. Dan, I believe that the president has declared the emergency and that FEMA will be springing into action. Are you optimistic, sir?
I don't know about the springing part, but I'm glad that at least it was declared. Of course, you know, this business in Iran, in Iraq, has pushed all other subjects off the table, and there's, you know, huge need right now. And, you know, Puerto Rico's sustained another gut punch.
Yeah.
And whether or not enough relief aid and aid can be assembled, and if the lessons from the last disaster were learned, hopefully people will begin to get the aid they need. But that's an open question, I think.
I mean, part of the problem is that the last disaster is still not completely fixed.
Correct. And that is what is really exacerbating the effects of this earthquake. And it's something that Puerto Rico has not seen in about 100 years. The last one was in 1918 that shook the island to this degree.
There was footage of a recording studio or a radio station. It looked very similar to Studio A. And there was a clock on the wall, and they had the camera going, and you could see the shaking, and it was like 20, 30, 40
yeah.
seconds.
Yeah.
And if anybody's been in an earthquake,
yeah.
every second seems like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been a bad one.
Yeah, and I think part of the lesson that was learned on the ground in Puerto Rico and with AIDS, I was my organization is part of a much larger network. And we raised, that network raised about $4 million in funds to aid Puerto Rico. But as a lot of the coverage post-Maria showed, a lot of that aid stayed in place, never got to the people. So there were pallets and pallets
of
water
yeah.
that stayed on the tarmac in some airports, never got to the people they needed it.
And do we know exactly the reason that it didn't get anywhere?
Well, just because the systems of relief were not really up to par, and there's a whole lot of information about what could have happened versus what did happen. So they had the Coast Guard ships off the coast, because remember, Maria was preceded by another hurricane, and they had these ships off the mm-hmm. coast of the island, and they moved them instead of keeping them in place. So a lot of kind of shots in the foot occurred during that day. But I am optimistic because what happened after Maria was that local on the ground nonprofit organizations, citizens organizations were able to respond in a way that government is not able to. So what we're trying to do right now, instead of doing these mass fundraising campaigns, is to be more strategic. So we're hearing calls, for instance, from the island for tents because people are afraid to sleep in their homes.
Yeah.
So that's a big need for walkie-talkies and those types of aids, as opposed to, you know, sending all this stuff that never gets to people and people don't really need in this moment. And so I would hope that your listeners would keep looking at our Facebook page, Capital District Latinos, because we're going to be putting on that page a way to get aid more strategically to people on the island. So, for instance, I've already heard that in some of the schools that are acting as shelters, that if you send a care package to the school in Ponce or in Guayanilla, people are more likely to get the aid they need directly, as opposed to sending it through an organization that then has to go through a hierarchy and a whole organization chart in order to get the funds out.
You know, the Maria, the hurricane that struck and devastated Puerto Rico, it had so many similarities, to Katrina. Right.
Absolutely.
When FEMA, was it Michael Brown, I believe was his name,
Great job, Brown.
Happened to be a friend of
Bush,
the president, and contributed to a campaign, who was appointed that very important position, and quite frankly mishandled, you know, the initial response to Katrina. You know, you would have thought that we would have learned our lesson from there. But then you see Maria, you know, take shape. And I think there were more celebrities, athletes, and citizens that did more in that relief than the actual government did for those people. And ironically, I was having a conversation earlier today about Flint, Michigan, right?
Oh, wow.
First of all, when you're looking at cities like Flint and Detroit, you know, in Michigan as a state, and you see what's happening in those cities, that should scare every American in every city, right? And we tend to think that Puerto Rico is this island that is out there that belongs to some...
Surrounded by water. Don't forget that.
It's the United States.
Away, yeah.
It's
a lot
part
of
the United States of America. And so we've abandoned the people of Flint and the people of Detroit. We've abandoned Puerto Rico. What's the next city, and what kind of excuse are we going to make for them when we fail other people?
Well, Dan, you concentrate on grassroots efforts, and that's excellent. I think that more citizens have to do that and get involved. But you seem to be almost forgiving of the Trump administration, which, why do citizens and organizations like yours have to do this? This is a function of government, and we did it in Houston, and we did it in places that the president considers important. And based on that, the way Puerto Rico has been treated, and other issues. Why is Trump able to claim that he has growing Latino support?
I think you're forgetting.
What the heck?
I think, Rosemary, you're letting your bias interfere with what we know about the president. He's very concerned about corruption, remember?
So we have, that's
oh,
true.
Wait a minute.
Remember the major FEMA corruption? The charge. Okay, I thought you were chastising
no,
me.
No, not
actually
at all.
Being,
not,
that
not
was
all.
Sarcasm.
Yes, it was sarcasm, but it was friendly sarcasm. I think that we have to also apply a political lens to this and say the president has already shown that he doesn't care about Puerto Rico. He doesn't care about localities where people are brown and black, and he has a preference.
And Democrats.
For his own, yeah, and has a preference for keeping the red states happy and the blue states not so much.
Well,
that's
isn't the irony then that this particular president ignores the real calamity that's taking place in Puerto Rico, but then uses a Sharpie to try to create calamity for Alabama, which is
that's
a solid red state, because
with.
He wanted to direct relief there.
We're dealing with, you know, hubris, we're dealing with prejudice, and all of these things, we're so used to it now that it almost
desensitizing,
doesn't faze
us. So why the Latino support, which Trump is boasting about?
And I will explain that to you. What people don't understand about Hispanics is that they are at the core, by reason of conquest, very religious.
Oh, religious. Okay.
Okay? So you have a lot of Catholics, like Latin America was all Catholics, but then the Protestant sects began to make deep inroads into the Catholic territory. So you have a kind of irony there, because Latino people have been exploited by the United States, by superpowers, and they've been divided. And look at this, the condition of places like Venezuela, places like Colombia today. I mean, that's all an after effect of the policies that we have held for years with regard to Latin America and our, you know, constant fear of Soviet takeover. But what we have to realize is that this president, he sees things in purely political terms. Like, how is it advantageous for me to help these folks who hate me? And so if he thinks that, you know, that's one of the reasons I think that the Republicans would never vote for making Puerto Rico 51st state.
Would you vote for that?
My inclination throughout my youth has always been towards independence, because I do think that Puerto Rico has a highly educated population. I think that there are ways that they could monetize some of the resources that they have. I think the people are incredibly entrepreneurial, and I think that that might have a shot, like Taiwan, for instance, mm-hmm. that did something similar. So there are models out there for independence to work. However, it's almost a moot point because, you know, when you're a territory, you're a commonwealth, i.e. colony, what choices do you have?
I also find it interesting that in the United States, we have this obsession with creating boxes for people. So you speak Spanish, therefore you're Hispanic, therefore you're one large monolithic group. And then, you know, when you're talking about politics, people make the mistake of believing that anyone who is of Hispanic descent are politically and ideologically similar. And then you look at South Florida and you see our Cubano friends and you realize that, you know, you're talking about some of the most conservative people, deeply religious, Bay of Pigs, Fidel Castro. These are dye-in-the-wool Republicans.
Yep.
That's how you get a unicorn like Rubio. You
know. So it's really important to look at
unicorn.
I call them unicorns, man. It's like, how can you grow up? It's the same thing I say about, you know, black Republicans, too.
I think
how could you grow up with all of the experiences that we've grown up with and all of a sudden look at Donald Trump and say, yeah, that's my man right there. You come on.
I say it about Women for Trump. Same idea. Yeah. And they're another big group that cannot be put into. They're not all the same. Definitely all women are. But I do say, why would you be a woman and find self-interest in voting for Trump? And I still feel that about blacks and about Latinos.
Oh, I think
unless
that it's
abortion.
I think it's very critical to look at Trump's strategy in Florida. Mm-hmm. What did he do in Florida? Mm-hmm. He went to this mega church.
Yeah.
He got the imprimatur of this evangelical guy who's kind of like Jimmy Swaggart or of the Latino community. And he went there and he made his argument that, you know, whatever you think of him, he's held up anti-abortion legislation. I mean, he's enacted anti-abortion legislation. He's for all of these things that align with conservative Christians. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, Latino conservative evangelicals are the same as white conservative evangelicals.
Exactly.
In the mindset.
Interesting.
Yeah. And in that particular appearance, there were a number of people that did not go to church that day fear of being deported.
That's right.
So there's the irony, right?
Yeah. The other thing is that I saw that you were mentioning the Cubano issue. I saw a study that said the children of the conservatives are becoming more liberal than their parents.
And that is absolutely correct. There's a generational pull in that case. I think I must say this, and I don't know if anybody from the DNC is out there listening, but I mean you're missing a major, major opportunity by not focusing. There should be buses leaving New York State to register Puerto Ricans in Orlando and in that whole I-90 corridor.
Yeah.
To vote their interest, because it is clear, and this is the second time that it is now inescapable, that Donald Trump cares nothing about Puerto Rico or Puerto Ricans.
And you can't have, the evidence can't be any more telling than that, right?
Right.
And once again, you know, Puerto Rico, because if you go right down, you know, the line, the timeline, because it was interesting. I was looking at my notes, making notes in preparation for today's program, but I had old notes.
Yes, he prepares, Alan.
I had old notes, and you know, we were talking about, at one time, talking about Puerto Rico, and we then started talking about North Korea. and, you know, all the things that, that Trump had done to basically eliminate Puerto Rico from the headlines,
yes,
and social conscience, right? So once again, here we are with Puerto Rico experiencing this devastating earthquake, and most people are talking about Iran.
Soleimani.
Yeah.
We got the bad guy.
Yeah, we got the bad guy.
But, I mean, we did that too, right?
No, you know what? It's not as if – this is the reason why I was very happy with when we were having these conversations earlier, because Judith Inc. would always remind people about the fact that even in her environmental discussion, she would always remind people that what's happening in Puerto Rico and these other serious aggressive storms that are happening all over the place were, in fact, as a result of what's happening into the environment. But Judith would always include the Puerto Rico piece in her conversation. I think we can have a lot of different conversations at the same time.
And she was a real expert on that because Puerto Rico was in Region 2, she was in charge of, in the environmental area.
Absolutely. And I have to do a shout out to the governor for having the presence of mind to continually, when there are disasters here, to send people from New York to help. That's just a real thing.
Well, in just plain political terms, you know, there is a method to the madness there because you have a very strong political base of Puerto Ricans in the state of New York, and we know that we like to go back home, go back and forth to our homes, and so when people are migrating to New York,
oh absolutely,
they know who
people migrate to New York. When did that start?
Some of us still love the state of New York.
Agreed, and it's a wonderful place. I'm still here, right? But I'm one of the few left, but I'm still here. Hey, by the way, while we were talking, Alan Shartok walked in. And,
I did.
And how was the media project today? Good. I'll take that as a positive.
Yes, ask Rosemary. She knows more about this.
Well, Alan didn't talk as much as usual. Maybe that's but you were very pungent and funny.
I was up.
He's usually pungent.
But he didn't talk as much as usual. Maybe that's why he thinks it's meh.
I just take exception to the way you described him as walking in. He doesn't walk. He saunters.
Really?
Or limps.
Well, you were limping. limp.
At 1 o'clock in the morning, I got up and got out of bed, got in the car, and drove to WAMC. So I am not in the strongest position.
Mike, the engineer, is going to break the window if you keep doing that to the microphone.
I keep, messing with the microphone.
Yeah, hey, we have to take a break here, and we'll get a stern lecture from Mike, the engineer, in a moment. The email
address
is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. David Soares, Dan Irizarry, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok are here. We will be back after a brief news. Oh, that's nice. That's Taimani. The album is Elemental, and Taimani is a ukulele virtuoso playing at the GE Theater at Proctor's in Schenectady on Saturday night, proctors.org, if you want to find out more. The email address here is panel@wamc.org. It's the Roundtable Panel. David Soares is here, Dan Irizarry, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok as well. Governor Cuomo delivered his State of the State address Wednesday, outlining his vision for progress on addressing intolerance, legalizing adult use marijuana in New York.
Yay.
The third term Democrat is navigating a looming $6 billion budget shortfall, as politicians are wont to do. He touted his biggest past achievements, trumpeted a long list of future policy initiatives, and it was a lot of applause, and it was very exciting. Alan, your thoughts first, and then we're going to go to David Soares.
I would think we could go right to David Soares. However, I have to say that what he didn't do, to my satisfaction, of course, I don't live in New York State, were number one to say exactly how he was going to get around that $6 billion budget deficit that we have.
While lowering middle-class taxes, which is a trick.
Right. He said that.
Yeah.
He said he had lowered taxes, and he took on, of course, in his classic way, he and Mayor de Blasio don't do well together. so he said, one of the things we'll do is take back the Medicaid reimbursement that we give New York City and other places, and that will save us a whole hell of a lot of money. And I'm sure, knowing Andrew the way that I do, you know, this was a shot that was deliverable. But the other part of this that he did not really get into was the question of bail, and that's where we want to talk to David Soares.
Exactly. Democrats earlier in the month signaled an opening for changes to bail reform, which I know you've been a big fan of. So let's go to you, David.
You were
Soares.
Being sardonic, weren't you, when you just said that?
I don't know anymore.
Yes, you were.
I have no idea anymore.
I'm just happy that we have. We're paying some respect to the ukulele today.
Okay. You'll be getting some more shortly. Yes. So,
well, look, I think we can reduce the conversation to basically this. We have people who are very much for bail reform, including prosecutors, including police, that are speaking about bail reform in the context of social and economic justice, right? And I believe that public safety, people in public safety, we're coming at the issue of bail from the perspective of public safety. We've been talking past one another. We've been talking past one another in the formation of the Latrice Walker bill that eventually passed. We've been talking past one another after it was passed, when we were providing all of the warning signs to our legislature, to our governor, of what's going to happen. And January 1st rolled around, and we didn't even get out of the very first week of January without calamity occurring all over the state
as predicted by some
bail reform.
Yeah.
Right. And so the question now is, are we going to continue to observe people accused of criminal homicide walking out of the courts because they put in, you know, a bail app with absolutely no collateral? Are we going to continue to read about people who are raping children walking out of court without any collateral for bail? Surely, and I have to believe this, I don't think our legislative leaders ever intended for bail reform to benefit the kind of people who we've been reading about in our local papers. I don't believe that they were the audience that this was designed to benefit. And so we have to come back and revisit this.
But
and the fixes are simple.
But are you suggesting then that Albany was deaf to the entreaties of those in law enforcement who were saying this before it passed?
I was the president of the New York State District Attorneys Association, and we did not receive audience at all from leadership prior to this bill passing. There was never a forum that was put together where they invited subject matter experts, even experts from the people who disagreed with us. There was never that opportunity for debate and deliberation. Because, quite frankly, we supported about 85% of the bail reform recommendations. Mm-hmm. The things that we were really concerned about was the fact that they were stripping judges of their discretion, but they were also not allowing for us to consider public safety. So think about this. In order to address the issue of social and economic justice, public safety was sacrificed in order to achieve that. And that's the simplest way to explain what's just transpired.
So on the one hand, it's really difficult. So on the one hand, we get a bunch of newly elected Democrats who say we want to be progressive and we want to show that progressivity, and they pass this bill perhaps too fast, not perhaps, absolutely too fast. And they do have on their minds this big issue, which is, let's be fair, the rich people can do bail, the poor people can't do bail. Right, David?
True. So that's true.
So, and on the other hand, we're now seeing a woman slapping two Jewish women in the face. And the criteria is it can't be violent in order to get this. Well, when you slap somebody in the face, that's violence, as far as I can see. Yeah.
Violence is a term of art, right? Violence is a term of art in the penal law and in the criminal procedure law. So crimes like manslaughter are considered nonviolent crimes in the penal law. So how you ask yourself, how does that happen? So what we were trying to caution our legislators and our leaders about was the fact that if they decided to write a simple bill that just looked at categories of crimes, you were inviting chaos because there were so many unforeseen problems, right? So, for example, a person in Cohoes, we have an individual whose infant of just barely several weeks ingested lethal amounts of drugs and died. That person has been charged in Albany County. That person has been in held with bail that was, we've asked for high bail, judge set high bail. January 1st, that issue was revisited. That individual has now been released under the supervision of probation, right? I don't think that the legislators had envisioned that kind of outcome when they took action. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, right? So it's not just an economic, fairness or social justice issue. It's a public safety issue. And the only thing that we're asking is that public safety be considered.
So what's the fix?
The fix is, hey, do what New Jersey did, because I know our governor is famous for saying that, you know, New Jersey's done it and look, they're okay, except that what you passed was not like New Jersey. New Jersey still allows for judges to maintain some discretion, and New Jersey still allows for judges to consider dangerousness as an issue in making that determination. That's the only thing that we're asking.
So,
in terms of
judges are different. In other words, there are different judges and they have different mentalities. And once you start saying you can decide what dangerousness is, you run into this business about you don't know what's going to happen.
Well, and that's the argument that they come back with, that people come back with, was like, well, if you give a judge discretion, the outcomes will be the same, where you have disproportionality. It's like, okay, so first and foremost, let me just be on record here as saying the original bail statute was a great bail statute. What wasn't great was its application. And so if you want to cure the outcomes, you begin training people. You begin educating judges. And you try to make sure that they're working so that you're not having these disparate outcomes.
So how come the governor yesterday in that speech, which I listened to every word of, how come the governor didn't bring the bail thing up?
I don't think he was interested in bringing that up because, quite honestly, we're looking at the fact that every single person is running for office this year. And to address bail, fixing bail now, would invite primary challenges. And I don't think that there's necessarily an appetite or an interest to do that.
Yes, but there's right and wrong.
There is right and wrong. So I think what will happen is there will be conversations that'll take place behind the scenes, and any fix that you see will certainly occur after petitions have been filed.
But, I mean, there's clearly political pressure to do this sooner rather than later.
There's political pressure to do that because what you've seen in terms of these hate crimes that have taken place. Now, we could say we're gonna come up with tougher, you know, penalties for hate crimes. But the reality is, and let me just say this, you happen to have a bus stop right here in front of your building.
We do certainly have that.
Right? So I could walk outside right now, and I could look at someone, and based upon their ethnic background, their faith, if I can identify those things, I could slap a person walking off the bus today. I would be taken to a court. I would be released. I could come right back to the bus stop and find a different person, not the same person, but find a different person and smack that person.
It's already happening.
And I would continue to go in and out of the system with multiple victims. That's what happens when you deprive judges of discretion, and that's what happens when you deprive judges of the ability to consider dangerousness.
Let's take a quick break here. I know one of the big bits of news yesterday, much like last year's State of the State, Governor Cuomo pushing to legalize adult-use marijuana. We got a yay out of Rosemary Armea when we mentioned it earlier, and we will get back to that topic. The email address here is panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC 946. It's Thursday by Mike. No, is it Thursday? Yeah. right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Yeah, one day goes into the next. 3 weeks from today is the scheduled day that our buddy Joe Donahue returns.
Oh, wow. Can't wait.
Yeah, man.
Nor can he wait.
Nor can I.
Joey D.
Ray, I want to say it one more time.
Oh, God, here we go.
Everything you've done is so appreciated by all of us. Well, I got stopped at the cannabis outlet? No, over to the co-op yesterday. This guy comes up to me and says, "You're not paying Ray Graff enough money."
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, what's that guy's name?
And I said, "You're right,
Ray Graff Jr." the experience, a similar experience, is I remember in elementary school when one of my teachers would go out on maternity leave, and then you'd have a sub for two months, 3 months,
And it was always the worst when the poor band teacher came in to sub, and then everybody would change instruments and he'd start yelling and. The good old days. The email address is panel@wamc.org. No. So one of the things Governor Cuomo talked about was legalizing adult use marijuana. As we have mentioned, it's been economically successful in Massachusetts. It's being discussed elsewhere. And, well, Rosemary, we'll give it to you first.
Why?
Because she said yay.
Oh, yeah.
Because
I said yay. I'm a proponent of this. I think that it's past time. Public opinion about marijuana use is clearly in favor of using it. There is a lot of money to be made. I was just saying to Alan, I think that the only people who would be unhappy with this would be Massachusetts, anyone in Massachusetts, because they're making a ton of money from
our town of Bay Barrington.
Right on the border.
Well, yeah. We have one that's operational, and you can see the cars lined up with the Connecticut, New York license plates. But there are five that have been given, I believe five that have been giving permits.
Great Barrington is a little town.
7,000 people.
Yeah, there's a market for this. How many liquor stores are there in the States?
In Great Barrington?
In the States, oh. Yeah.
And look, and you know, it's right on the corner of Connecticut.
Yeah,
and New York, and they were there first. So there are others that are opening up that aren't doing as well in the Berkshires.
I also think that what this will do, and that's a good thing too, is to put pressure on the federal government to change the Jeff Sessions law that it's still federally, it's a crime.
Well, Albany County District Attorney David Soares, you were ahead of this curve to some extent in that a year ago, was it, or two, you said we won't prosecute certain marijuana crimes.
Yeah, we've decriminalized we won't prosecute lower level offenses, and we then, you know, take a hard look at cases that come in that are of certain quantities, just because it's silly. It is absolutely silly for law enforcement to be wasting our precious resources at this point in time in history, knowing what we know about the product, to continue looking at this as a gateway drug, or to continue looking at this as if it's creating any more havoc than, for example, alcohol.
Now, prior to you making that move, I know you went out to a conference, I think, in Colorado.
I was in Colorado for 1 week. Colorado puts together the greatest conference where they bring in all the different players to educate you as to how the entire statute evolved and how they were able to implement their strategies.
They have a statute. They were the first, I believe.
Constitutionally, yes. Constitutionally, people are entitled to grow, I believe, three plants or six plants per household.
All right. Now, my question for you before I throw it back to Alan, is there any sort of inkling of whether, much like Prohibition, the end of Prohibition did some damage to the mafia's hold on black market liquor. Is there any sign that the black market pot market has been curtailed in Colorado?
Oh, no. Much contrary to that prevailing thought, it's only expanded the black market there.
Because, how so?
Because constitutionally, people are entitled to grow their own plants, and you have to remember that each plant every 3 months will give you anywhere from 1 to 3 pounds.
Wow.
And so if you're entitled to, let's say, have four plants at a maximum, you're going to be looking at about 12 pounds every 3 months.
Which
means
you want to sell it.
Yes. And so you have absolutely more than you will ever be able to consume. And therefore, the neighboring states around Colorado, that still have prohibition, it's easier to export those products out to those neighboring states for higher profits.
But I mean, I can't make my own booze. Why is it they put in the law that, oh yeah, you can grow your own? Why didn't they just keep it? We're going to tax this. We're going to have growers.
And this is the only issue that I take, and I would work to make sure that this didn't happen in New York. Giving people the opportunity to grow marijuana in their own homes causes all sorts of secondary problems, right? In addition to mold, in addition to people who have an excess amount that's growing and now they want to convert the vegetation to edibles, they need to use butane and all sorts of very explosive products to achieve that goal. In Colorado, you have homes that are blowing up in suburban communities. You have realtors that have a lot of problems selling homes because of the mold and all these other collateral issues. Because you need to use butane in order to actually remove the THC from the vegetation. Yeah. And just like people making booze at home, people try to, you know, use duct tape and engage in this very volatile process where in Colorado, the legitimate industries, they use these first-class labs to achieve those goals.
Now, I knew this politician who said, you know, that marijuana was a gateway drug. It was going to lead to people using other...
Which politician?
Andrew Cuomo. And he had a huge change of heart. Probably because he saw things going the other way. I can't speak for him because I wasn't, you know, in his head. But it really did make a huge difference. But somehow he hasn't gotten it done. Instead of New York doing it, and he now says, well, we have to do it with New Jersey and Connecticut. This is a guy who has never played that well with other people in the playpen.
So I think the simple answer there, well, two things. First, I think that, you know, as an elected official, he certainly has the right to evolve in his positions, and you know, because you know certainly a lot more about marijuana than you did, let's say, a year ago, 2 years ago. So I believe he's entitled to evolve on the position. But I think part of the problem is that there is also a social justice, economic justice issue that is associated with marijuana in terms of constructing a marketplace here in the state of New York. But I will say that marijuana continues to be a gateway drug only in this regard, that people who are addicted to harsher drugs are now using marijuana and getting off of the more life-threatening drugs. So it's a gateway out of addiction to the more serious
products. And we know that.
That's fascinating.
Products.
Yeah, yes. That's something you don't hear all the time, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So it's not a gateway. Marijuana is not a gateway drug to get into harder drugs, but it certainly is a gateway drug to get out of
harder
drugs.
I hate to throw a stink bomb into all of this, but...
good point.
There is something that we have to take seriously, and that is that because the ability to make these strains so potent, there are groups, there are demographics that are consuming this drug that are ending up in psychosis and ending up at a startling rate in Colorado especially in the emergency room. So while I understand and I agree with the social justice aspect of this and reducing the criminality and all of that, I still think that we have to be wary of the fact that this drug will be consumed and some people will overconsume and end up in these psychotic episodes.
It must be heavily regulated. I mean,
Isn't this the same as alcohol?
It must be heavily regulated because, as you say, I was told when I was in Colorado that if the last time you smoked marijuana was when Van Halen's Jump was on the American Top 40, they don't even sell that kind of marijuana anymore because it's just garbage. Right, so the THC and potency has certainly gotten much more. Depending on who you are, you might like the fact that it's a stronger product. But the because of the competitive nature, right? Someone's always got to be trying to move to the next to the next stage.
Right.
The next stage of all of this is edibles. Mm-hmm. There are bath bombs with THC ointments and everything else at one of the stores that we visited.
Bath bombs?
Yes.
Bath bombs.
Nice.
And in Great Barrington, there's a big to do over the fact that somebody wants to come in and take over several acres and grow the stuff. And the neighbors are saying, hey, we don't want it. It's going to stink. Our kids are going to be close to it. And I happen to be siding with them. I have to announce that. And the people who want it say, wait a second, that was originally supposed to be, a place where people could start businesses and regulated that way. Nevertheless, I don't think everybody counted on the way that this was going to develop.
There are so many unintended consequences. For example, is not one single square foot of warehouse space left in Colorado because what's happened in Colorado is this. So because everyone has a right to grow a certain amount of marijuana for themselves for personal use, a lot of industries have popped up where they will take on the growing of the marijuana for you, just like you would call in a prescription to CVS. You have your prescriptions and everything with that particular company, and so you're going every month to pick up your pack. You're providing them with a certain fee for doing it for you. But for those people that can't afford that service, they're doing it in their own homes. As a result, you're seeing much more water pollution. They say that one warehouse growing marijuana uses more energy than the local hospital, right?
Wow.
So there's a whole host of certain problems that were unforeseen that they too were grappling with and seem to be grappling with consistently.
Well, the email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And do keep the letters brief. We'll get to them at the other side of the news. David Soares is here, Dan Irizarry, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Shartok. Once again, panel@wamc.org, and we will break for news. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Thursday morning. 10:05 is the time. We're listening to music of Taimani from the album Elemental today. And Taimani will be at the GE Theater at Proctor's on Saturday night, proctors.org. This is the Roundtable panel. We have investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo with us today, Chairman of Capital District Latinos Dan Irizarry, Albany County District Attorney David Soares, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. The email address is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And what do you say, Alan? We read some of the email.
Okay. I expect that there'll be a deluge of people writing to us on the marijuana question.
Okay.
There always is.
All
however,
right.
Let's start. Hispanic vote for Trump. Good morning, panel. Daniel, according to some polls, almost 30% of Hispanic voters plan on voting for Trump in 2020. How does the Democratic candidate overcome that and win back the presidency? I know Hispanics are not a monolithic voting bloc, but as a dumb white guy, I don't get it. Well, you did explain it, didn't you, Dan?
I think, again, going back to the issue of religion, colonization, all of those things, I know that they're kind of boring and in the weeds, but it is true that the Hispanic community has a large component that is pro-life, and on that issue alone, they will galvanize and support a candidate who is pro-life as well.
But, I mean, no group is a monolithic group. I mean, dumb white guys. There are dumb white guys who vote Democrat. There's dumb white guys who vote for Republican. It's not a monolithic group. So it's tough to pigeonhole everybody into one group.
Well, when you poll, you can see percentages, can't you, Ray? I mean, for example, we know, as we mentioned before, that Cubano, older people who came from Cuba, these were basically the anti-Castro people, and they were very conservative. But their kids are changing, and we could pick that right up with the polling.
I've just never seen any kind of polling for dumb white guy caucuses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
I didn't realize there was a group.
Well, you know, in South Florida also there's the Venezuelan population. Mm-hmm. The Venezuelan population has been looking at what's happening in their country. And they were promised that there was going to be, you know, they were going to get rid of Maduro. And that hasn't happened. And so the Trump administration raised the level of expectation. And now, you know, you have all kinds of craziness going on there. And I think that that's also, I know that's kind of in the weeds, but that's also a segment of the Hispanic population that will, that might vote, and that vote might turn on what happens in Venezuela.
It's interesting because when I was a kid, grew up 91 Lorraine Street in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and the mill town, we had everybody on my street. And so, you know, you have your Puerto Rican families, your Colombian families, your Dominican families, and anyone who thinks that just because they happen to share a language that we're talking about the same culture, well, surprise, surprise, that's just not true.
We heard from Rusty in Altamont, who had a question for you, David, District Attorney Soares. Can you talk about marijuana breathalyzers? Mm. I read in numerous places that one of the holdups last legislative session was that some lawmakers were insisting on marijuana breathalyzers being implemented. I never hear anything good about these breathalyzers. It seems to be yet another tool to lock up people when the point of legalization is to reduce the number of incarcerated. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a major obstacle to seeing this legislation pass, and that is the fact that technology for detection, specifically technology not only for detection but technology to determine whether or not there's a causal effect between the amount of THC and your ability to operate a motor vehicle, there's really not a lot of good technology out there.
Right.
Saliva is something that's been discussed. Blood certainly is the best way to determine the level of THC. But part of the problem is that you can inhale marijuana, smoke marijuana, and have it in your presence, but it's such a fleeting amount of time before you'd have to almost do it and get blood within the hour of you.
Because the half-life of the drug is so
exactly
short.
So
interesting.
You'd be able to establish that there was presence of THC, but you wouldn't be able to establish whether or not the level of THC was actually impacting
Comparing
your ability.
The driver.
I know about this from drug testing for jobs or anything like that. But I thought it was the problem is that if you had imbibed in the past, it lingers. So it's not like alcohol.
Oh, it does linger, and that's the problem.
So you can't tell if somebody.
What you don't want to do is create a process where a person who may have ingested on Saturday is driving to work on Monday, and you know they may have not necessarily used the blinker to cross into another lane, and that person gets stopped.
That's a huge hurdle, though.
You're using huge saliva as a swab.
Unintended consequences. This is what we don't really know. We can't anticipate.
Of course, there ought to be a different standard for state legislators.
Ouch. Oh, man. Really?
Zing.
Really?
He deserves it. I'm sorry.
So tight. You know what? My wife is listening right now. If I ever blame my wife for anything, oh my God. It's like, no, you need to take me to jail because I just blame my wife and I don't want her to come near me.
Protective custody.
Yeah. What
how many?
Didn't you hear it? Like, allegedly. Yes. Right, go ahead.
There's just been a string of events with politicians, the House of Representatives from California,
DWI?
Who just stepped down because of the misuse of campaign funds. And what does he do? He blames his wife. I'm like, where are these guys going after arraignment?
Yeah. Well,
longstanding tradition of blaming
your wife.
I was
talking to a state senator one day, who shall go nameless, and his wife was standing there with him, and we were having a nice conversation. And I said, well, how will you avoid the same corruption issues that everybody else, you know, faces all the time? And I said, and he babbled a little bit, and she looked at him and she said, you better not.
I want to go home and cuddle with my wife, man. I don't need that kind of stress. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
I know what you're saying. Okay, and here's a letter on me. Greg, bail reform. Alan keeps citing a woman who slapped someone. Alan, could you remember the basics of our justice system? Innocent until proven guilty.
That's not true.
What?
Jeez. Look, the term innocent until proven guilty is to reflect who has the burden, and that's the people, okay?
Yes. And
so just to give this gentleman an example, if you get slapped in the face, guess what? You've been slapped. Right?
Right.
The person who slapped you committed a crime. That person, there's probable cause to believe that person committed a crime. There's evidence to suggest that person committed a crime. When we temporarily relieve that person of their liberty, it doesn't mean that that person is an innocent person sitting in jail awaiting trial.
Presumed
they
innocent.
Just haven't been convicted yet. And there's a presumption of innocence, and the presumption of innocence is just to reflect who has the burden of proof.
Okay, because on every press release we get from the Albany DA's office, at the bottom it says, you know, presumed innocent.
And that's exactly what we say. Every person is presumed innocent for the purpose of not injecting, you know, the thought of guilt into the prospective juror.
Okay. So that was that interesting letter. And Jamie says, Bail Act reality. The problem is that many people only get access to drug treatment when they get arrested and wind up in the criminal justice, in quote, system. I fear this will be used as an excuse to avoid the cost of that treatment simply by saying, we are providing justice, we let you go. We need to provide the same access to treatment for people out on release as those incarcerated.
Let me just point something else out here. The other unintended consequence of all of this is that in Albany County, we have a great sheriff, Craig Apple.
He is great.
He has used his jail as really a transitionary space as opposed
Absolutely.
To a place where
Absolutely.
We're incarcerating people. And for people with addiction, serious addiction, that has been the place that we've used bail to keep people in order to be seen by people who can do assessments and then connect them to treatment. And here is the major issue, right? People who are coming out of corrections and being mandated to treatment, they get their treatment paid for. People who are walking off the street to go receive treatment,
nope.
Most of them don't have health insurance, okay? Yeah. And so by creating this bail statute, it has created a tremendous gap for people who are, you know, I get called, right? I get called by parents who want me to have their children arrested so that their children are put in trouble.
Yeah. Wow.
Right?
That's
a reality. And I'm not suggesting to you that we need to invest in creating a coercive treatment, you know, architecture. But if this is where we're going with respect to bail, then you better create that other process where people get immediate access and treatment paid for.
And if I can add another layer to that, very often there are comorbidities with addiction. So probably around 40-45% of people who are addicted have underlying mental health issues.
Yeah.
And so that is another thing to consider in this whole discussion, because you're depriving people of an ability to be assessed, and in that assessment you can identify exactly why that person is falling into those patterns.
Yeah, and I can tell you that just as a person who's now been in this business for a period of 20 years, I mean, I've gone from a point of watching our system, you know, punish to a place where, you know, the system right now has more in place to help people than it ever had before. Albany has the Albany Lead, which mm-hmm. officers are trained to take people directly from the street, not even arrest them, but take them from the street and place them into some kind of treatment or provide some other intervention. And so mm-hmm. all along the criminal justice continuum, we're finding ways to divert people so that people are getting help where they need to. And so those are the issues that need to be really considered as we're moving forward and thinking about reengaging on the issue of bail.
And I think it also goes to the continuing disaster we have politically of people's inability to sit at the table and talk. And that is a result of the contagion of, you know, Pennsylvania Avenue.
I'll say this too, and this is just to Alan. You know, the one person who indulged a lot of us prosecutors at the table was Senator Jamal Bailey. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Senator Jamal Bailey and I could not disagree more.
Right.
There are issues that we just cannot agree. But I have tremendous respect for him, and he articulates his positions very well. And so you understand where he's coming from. You understand the pressures that he's experiencing. He also takes the time to listen to us. I really miss that in government. I really do.
We heard from Matt, who says, bail reform? Bail allows people with money to get out of jail while most people, poor people, remain behind bars. And then he has some more here. Why is bail important for public safety, says Matt, and asks it of you, David.
Well, first of all, yes, bail is important to ensure that people continue to remain continue to return to deal with what the allegations of what of the crimes that they've been charged with, accused of committing. Pardon me. But we also have to consider public safety. If a person who is out and he's just stabbing people, you know, it could be in a public place, but just stabbing people, you know, that person is going to be arrested. Do you really want that person released because, you know, they express the desire to continue coming back to court and continuing on with the prosecution? No. You don't want that person out in a position where he can either create more harm to other people or create harm for himself. So the issue of dangerousness has to be part of the discussion with any kind of discussion about bail.
And you know what's interesting, too, is that, Barr is going to
Attorney
be,
General.
Has been,
a,
Attorney
yeah.
General Barr has
That's
been
right.
has been crisscrossing the country talking about issues like bail reform.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans are going to make this a huge campaign issue. And I guarantee you, well, I can't guarantee you, but I would lay odds right now, put money on the fact that Trump is probably going to point to something that happened in New York and say, this is what the liberal Democrats want to do. They want to let criminals free to go and kill your family.
But can you do that on a federal level, though?
Well, so here is it's amazing that you're touching on this, because this is the conversation I've been having with our legislators. You know, we know that we've needed to do reform on bail. We know that we needed to do discovery reform. And I cautioned them about going too far, because mm-hmm. what's going to happen is exactly what you're seeing happen right now. And the pendulum is going to swing, because you have attacks right now on the Democrats in the Senate in Long Island. You have attacks right now, and the political winds are going to shift if we don't change this right now. But the problem is, it's always going to be the same people who pay that price.
Yeah,
it's going to
That's
be
right.
poor. Mm-hmm. People from minority communities that will continue to pay that price. Because remember, I was the guy that wanted reform of the Rockefeller drug laws. And the Rockefeller drug laws were laws that really destroyed, you know, mm-hmm. African-American, Hispanic communities.
Okay, so we heard from Shane. While I agree there needs to be more room for judges to make discretionary decisions, the whole conversation around bail reform smacks of classism. Rich people who have been accused of dangerous crimes or have been convicted of crimes before can get out of on bail.
It doesn't make you feel any better that wealthy murderers are out on the street. It doesn't make you feel any better that you have, you know, poor murderers out on the street either. We're not having a question. The issue isn't social justice, because everyone speaks about bail reform in the context of social and economic justice. I can agree with all of those points. The point that I'm making is that you also need to consider public safety. Look what's happening in New York City. A woman gets arrested for slapping a woman of Jewish of Jewish faith.
Two.
Right? She gets released. Goes back and smacks another one. Gets released. What do you think is going to happen on day three? These are the issues that we're dealing with, and that's just the high profile issues.
Right.
This is happening
it's
everywhere.
Emblematic of the
but
the
from a
issue.
Political perspective, this is a potential real loser for the Democrats who passed this bill.
It's a loser if they want to defend people who get arrested for slapping people because of their ethnic. It's a loser if you're defending something that makes very little sense to the average person.
Is there real resistance to making tweaks, what you've called tweaks to this law, or is it just inertia at this point?
Is resistance to because the group that moved this agenda forward has the backing of, you know, philanthropic organizations, of celebrities, and, you know, they have the ability to really present a challenge, you know, in a primary to some of these elected officials. And that's the truth.
And Andrew did not talk about it. I know there's a double negative in there somewhere for no reason at all. He didn't talk about it because it is just too volatile.
I think the day before he said it is a work in progress.
Yeah, work in progress.
I just want to also point something out specifically to the attacks on the Hasidic community that occurred several weeks ago. Mm-hmm. You know, because we've talked about bail, but we haven't talked about discovery. Under the new discovery rules, the person who was arrested will be receiving the victim's information, right? Addresses of all of those people who witnessed the event.
And
so
then,
now I've been attacked, but now you're also
going to let me out.
The defendant's going to know everything about me because within 15 days we have to turn that information.
You can't
over.
Redact things like
you can't
personal
redact
information.
You cannot redact anymore. What the advocates will tell you is that, oh, you can ask a judge for a protective order. And then the issue of defendants being able to apply to visit a crime scene, and we have one that's being heard today, right? Let me just give you the little background on the case. There's an allegation, a young lady who had been sexually assaulted at a particular business, and I will not mention the business. Defense attorney filed an application to visit that crime scene. Now, in this instance, it was a business. But they could do the same thing if it happens in the victim's home, right? And so these are the kind of outrageous, aspects of the bills that we're talking about. And this is what we want to cure. And it's not unreasonable.
But is it unreasonable for the defense to say, hey, we have to see this crime scene?
You know what? If there is an issue at the scene, in other words, if you're, and I'm not saying this about you, but, if you're a 400-pound person who's been accused of crawling through a window and raping a person, right?
Right,
and you see that this window is, a rather small window, that is one of those examples where you could see a court saying, we ought to.
What is it about 400-pound people and basements that keeps recurring in the political discourse?
Yeah,
maybe
only,
I have that effect
that.
On people.
Not only that, I don't know why, because Ray is somewhat svelte. He is, no question about it. So I don't know why. I don't know why David said, I'm not talking about you now.
I don't care. I can take it.
No, but
I have
not,
3 weeks to go, and then I'm done with this.
I saw his reaction when you guys were talking about the dumb white guy caucus. I saw his reaction, and I was like,
calm down.
Like,
he's
had enough.
Too.
He's had enough.
next letter.
Just, good morning, panel. Alcohol can be produced at home, up to 200 gallons of wine without a permit, and I think up to 10 gallons of spirits.
Really?
I didn't know that.
Oh, I didn't know it either.
Well, if you don't know it, then we're really in trouble.
I like to buy the stuff.
In order to mount the kind of room to grow plants that can produce a pound or more from each plant requires an enormous investment in very expensive lighting and irrigation equipment and an outrageous electric bill. Most home growers produce a tiny fraction of that and do not get a pound per plant. Most folks in Massachusetts grow indoors and are limited to 6 plants per adult in the household.
That is just not true.
That's not true.
That's just not
okay.
True.
Okay.
Margarita says, marijuana and driving determining DUI. Dear panel, marijuana remains detectable for days after use. If you were driving and pulled over, how would law enforcement determine whether or not you were under the influence? We did talk about
There's
that.
There's the sticky wicket.
Yeah. What is a sticky wicket?
I don't know. I think it's a croquet term.
I actually think it's a name of a particular hybrid of marijuana.
Sticky wicket?
Yes.
Yeah, 78% THC. Right.
I think they sell it in Great Barrington.
Delicious.
I think.
It's very relaxing.
I wouldn't be surprised. Chuck says, marijuana. Good morning, panel. As a group, your ignorance of the ravages of addiction and its cause is staggering. You want facts? Talk to people in recovery. Chuck.
I assume our DA has done that.
A fan. Big fan there, yeah.
Okay. Recreational marijuana, says Stephanie in Pogetown, Poughkeepsie. Dear panel and Mr. Soares, a question. Recreational marijuana is comparable to alcohol in terms of the legal status it should have in the opinion of many people, including me. However, for someone driving under the influence of alcohol, there's a reliable roadside test and a law to address offenses. Is there any reliable roadside test or a laboratory test? We did talk about that, but David, do you want to mention?
Yeah, at this point, I know Colorado, they're using, saliva swabs.
Is there any constitutional fight against that, a.k.a. or such as like a blood test where you can say, well, you can't give me a roadside blood test. This is against my rights.
Yeah, well, in the state of New York, that you can only look for blood if there's a fatality or some other kind of crash. We usually get search warrants on blood if blood is taken at a hospital.
Right.
And then you'll be able to determine not only, if it happens right away. In other words, it has to be some time some connection to the time that you've ingested it. But that therein lies the problem. You have a social justice, economic justice issue with recreational marijuana, but you also have the testing issue for roadside safety issues.
And police, by the way, have been known to say, "Judge, I smelled marijuana in the car."
Yes.
Is that enough?
Yeah. Well, smelling marijuana in the car gives you permission to search the car, right?
I see.
So those are the other issues that we have to consider. Now, if you have a product that has been legalized recreationally, how will that impact officers?
Well, you can't drink. You can't have an open container.
So we use a lot of the laws that are pre-existing with respect to alcohol. Mm. To arrive at those same conclusions. The other thing, too, is, I think if the state of New York is going to go in this direction, it has to provide funding for officers to then become
experts.
Experts, yeah.
Sure. And we heard from Jennifer. Mass cannabis laws. I'm a police officer in Massachusetts. The people of the state voted against the marijuana, The people of the state voted the marijuana laws into place before laws had been put into place. So as a police officer, my hands are tied. A single person can grow up to 10 plants in the state of Massachusetts.
Okay.
That number keeps changing. All right.
We have about a minute here. You can go a couple more if you
want. All right. I will do whatever you tell me,
all right,
Chief.
Sir.
Ed Amherst says, David Soares has to cite reading in the media about folks running amok when they are out of bail because he knows darn well the statistics very likely show that the vast majority of our fellow citizens do not commit violent crimes when they are out on bail. These kinds of scare tactics are disgraceful and unproductive.
Dude, read the rap sheets that we have. Come on, man. I mean, you're basically sitting there, writing the station and A, you're not familiar with the cases that I'm referring to, and you're not looking at the criminal histories that demonstrate that people this week were released, even though their criminal histories reflected dozens of times that they failed to appear. So I'm not just speaking and fear-mongering. What's happening right now is reality.
I mean, this is indicative of the discourse, the level of discourse, too, because you seem to me to be very rational in your approach, and the reader is taking the opposite tack without really considering that you're arguing rationally about how we can calibrate.
Absolutely.
This
all right, we have to take a break here. David Soares is here, Albany County District Attorney. Also, Dan Irizarry, Chairman of Capital District Latinos, investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. Email address is panel@wamc.org. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. It's the Roundtable panel on a Thursday morning. 10:34 is the time. Ray Graff with you and David Soares and Dan Irizarry and Rosemary Armeo and Alan Shartok. Our email address is panel@wamc.org.
Okay, and John says, question for Mr. Soares about bail. What is the role of the bail bondsman? I think this is a wonderful question. How does that process work, and why doesn't it adequately address the problem? So the question I have for you, David, isn't this putting the bail bondsman out of work?
It is. Yesterday we had an individual who filled out an affidavit where it was $20,000. It was an offense that we could, in fact, ask for bail. The bail had been, I believe, $75,000. The judge, upon the application by the defendant, reduced it to $20,000. And this individual signed an affidavit claiming that he's going to return or pay $20,000 if he fails to return. This individual signed an affidavit at the same where one of the questions, are you employed? And the answer to that was no. So now it's going to be, call it a pinky promise, affidavit, that they're going to return. That's what's happening.
And so there's no money to back it up.
There's even no
if he did
money
come
to back it up.
I see.
So the bail bondsman, for whom I feel very little affinity, get put out of business as a result of this open bail question?
Yes.
But well, that's a good thing, no?
But they're still in business because there are still those offenses that you can ask for high bail. Person who commits murder or a serious violent crime, you can still ask for bail, and therefore you have a bail bondsman.
And what does the bail bondsman do? He's like a bank?
The bail bondsman provides a bond for person to, in exchange for 10% of whatever the value of the of the bail was.
But so, if Defendant X leaves town, then it's on the bondsman to cover that?
Oh, that's when they go get Dog the Bounty Hunter.
But that is so interesting. So if it's $100,000, 10% of $100,000, you know, it's $10,000.
Yes.
But if it's $1 million, yep, it's $100,000. It's a lot of money. Well, I've never liked them. Anyway, I've been watching too much Gunsmoke.
Yeah, yeah. Do they have bail bondsmen on Gunsmoke?
No, but they do.
Kitty
have,
got sent up the river again?
They have bounty hunters.
Ah.
They have bounty hunters.
Right.
Well, I mean, I like the Mandalorian. I mean, he's...
Oh, God. There's
your
picture.
Baby Yoda. Baby Yoda's going to fix everything.
All right.
Baby Yoda.
Okay. Chris says, it is my understanding that bail is intended to ensure a defendant returns to court for trial. It is not intended to incarcerate an individual while he or she stands accused of a crime for which they have not yet been convicted. The idea of holding someone in jail for potentially weeks, months, or years based on dangerousness, in quotes, seems to conflate these two concepts. Could the district attorney comment?
There are people who present a danger to themselves and a danger to others. And in the past, we've always been able to use reputation in community, attachments to community, as a justification for, or the lack thereof, as a justification to ask a court for bail. DAs don't set bail, courts set bail. We will no longer have those options as of January 1st of this year. So a court is not allowed to consider dangerousness. Now, do not get confused the issue of a person who is innocent, right, and a person who is yet to be convicted. Again, a person who punches a person in the face. The person who got punched in the face got punched in the face. They're in pain. And the individual who did it, right, is accused of doing that. Hasn't been convicted of that. But let's not say that that individual is innocent. That's just not rational or logical.
But what if you're wrong? What if that person actually didn't? What if there was a bizarre circumstances where somebody who looked exactly like him punch somebody in the face?
And that happens all of the time, which you're supposed to provide a cursory review. A court is supposed to provide a cursory review to determine the weight of evidence that you have in making up and making these decisions. In addition to also looking at the exposure that individual was exposed to and to determine that.
But here I'll get into trouble. But the judge is sitting up there and all of a sudden a guy from MS-13, is that what it is, MS-13, mm-hmm, comes up and has a string of convictions or whatever else and arrests. This judge takes one look and said, this is a dangerous guy. But we have taken the power away from him to do anything about it in the short run, right?
That's exactly what we've done. What we've also done is those individuals who drive up here on a daily basis to bring, you know, fentanyl and cocaine onto our streets— those individuals, now when they're apprehended, they will also be released, unless we can establish that they are major traffickers. But you can't establish a person as a major trafficker unless you've been sitting on a wire and you can determine from all that information that that individual is somehow managing the operation and managing the distribution. So we are now prohibited from even seeking bail on those individuals who don't live in our communities but mule all of these products into our streets.
So what are the political implications here? The people who voted for it, who wanted bail reform, who recognize the injustice, mm-hmm, of the bail system right now, are going to be facing the electorate. And it seems to me that somebody who has had a crime committed upon them is going to say, hey, I don't want that guy out on the streets. And the real question is, how about all the other people who haven't had a crime who say it could be me who has this situation?
That's exactly the issue. And that's precisely the reason why I'm hoping that reasonable minds can get to a table and fix this. Again, there are people that are having the social justice conversation, but they're leaving out the public safety. And it's so convenient to have the social justice conversation because, you know what, it's an indefensible system. It's indefensible if what we're talking about is just social justice. But law enforcement, prosecutors, we can all agree that something needs to be done. And so we believe we should have fairness and equality. We just can't turn a blind eye to the fact that there are people who are really dangerous, who live amongst us. That's not fear-mongering. That is just a fact, or as I would say, it's Monday for me.
But there is a bigger question. Look, we take people, we don't educate people fairly, we don't give them what they need to have, then a higher proportion of those folks, not all by any means, commit crimes. In order to really solve all of this, you'd have to create social equity, which is different from what we're talking about now, which is one small aspect of that.
And you raise an excellent point. Look, I hate to say it, but I've been doing this for 20 years, right?
Sure.
And I agree. There are people who don't belong in prison. There are people that don't belong in jail. Right? They need to be removed from community, to isolate them from community, because the community that they're in, they continue to either create problems for themselves or problems are visited upon them. Right? So we have to figure out, how do we create more sentencing options for judges so that a person who may have an addiction but has done, you know, committed a violent felony to keep that addiction. How do we create another sentencing option for that person where we're not subjecting that person who's got a serious addiction but committed a violent felony to more dangerous people in an incarcerative state, right? Why aren't we doing more with youth, especially young people, where we have – it could be boot camps, right? And where you're on a campus where you're being exposed to education and perhaps trades, but that's what your sentence is, right? For whether it's for 2 years or 3 years, why aren't we doing those things? And the reality is, there are people who can stand on firm ground and gesticulate and pontificate all day about how the criminal justice system is terrible, but they're not advocating for anything else. And that's what I'd like to see this move, where I'd like to see this movement go.
And we've heard from Susan, who says, "Good morning, dear panel. Home growing, if done outdoor, uses about as much energy as growing a tomato plant. As a matter of fact, it's a lovely plant to add to your flower garden. Two plants will give enough product for a family for 1 year. Experienced home grower on a tight budget."
In East Africa, where I worked for a long time, it was common. Everybody had a little plot outside of marijuana. But in upstate New York, it's a little harder to grow pot outside.
You sound like you're speaking from experience.
I
think that letter was from Rosemary.
Tony says, "Marijuana, tobacco, is not grown in warehouses in the South. It is grown in the fields, where plants have been grown for thousands of years. It's ridiculous that we are growing this plant in warehouses."
They grow cigar wrappers in Connecticut. They have a nice area, and you can drive through rural Connecticut.
I'll tell you what, this song about plantations and fields when it's so early in the morning. I gotta say,
Alan, I wish there was the ratio of letters about Puerto Rico to marijuana are about running about 30-1.
Yeah. Yeah, right?
True.
However, this is epic that we have had. We're almost done, and we've not mentioned McConnell.
Okay,
Pelosi.
This is for you, Rosemary. We have 1 minute and 30 seconds.
Megxit.
Britain's royal family is scrambling to contain the fallout from the surprise announcement by Prince Harry and his wife Meghan that they intend to step back from royal duties. Oh, I don't care. Go ahead,
well,
Rosemary.
I don't care about sports either, but a lot of people
do care about
sports. Are we
talking about sports?
This, well, we do in all the breaks. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, well.
So it is of interest to a lot of people, and I am fascinated by that because we have this craziness about royalty, because Harry is such a sympathetic figure because he lost his mother and now he's trying to protect his wife. Isn't that cute? And because they are millennials, like so many other millennials, trying to balance work and family. Mm. As one wag said, I told you this. This is the first time he ever heard of someone quitting their family in order to spend more time with their job.
Irizarry said, "If you start talking about this, I'm leaving." And he's putting his coat on right now.
We only have a minute during Puerto Rico.
We only have a minute to go.
That's okay. I'm just
also, one more thing is that they now are dictating the terms with which they are going to deal with the media. The royals are followed not paparazzi, a pool. And
well, I mean,
saying, we're going to pick people now who are interested in
our I still haven't
causes.
Forgiven these people because my wife made me get up like at 3:00 in the morning to watch them get married. I haven't
really?
Forgiven these people at all, man.
You got up for that?
No, I didn't. I pretended.
In all seriousness, though, I think that you do bring up a point about kind of where we are in terms of historically moving away from this very antiquated idea of monarchy. Or,
exactly. Yeah.
And that's kind of a refreshing
thing.
Well,
I mean, listen, we fought a war so that I did not have to care about this, and we won the war.
There you go. Right,
can you convince these two people to go to Puerto Rico so that we have more of the paparazzi and media shining on
Actually, they're into charity. Maybe they will be.
What were you going to say, Ray?
I'm saying we're done. Oh. Thanks to Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Dan Irizarry.
Not an American one either.
Oh, I'm talking over here. David Soares, thank you all very much. Thank you for writing in. We're done with the program. Not the program, but the panel portion of the program. Oh. And there's much more to come, so I invite you all to stick around. This is the Roundtable, and are we good? All right, Mike Bowen, take it away.